I'd like to talk to you about not letting anything get between you and God. I know many of you are facing that challenge and struggling hard with it, making sure that nothing gets between you and God. And the area of greatest concern has to do with the things that we love. We're talking about being loving servants. And I'm going to take you in a bit to a passage where we have the very first reference of love in the Bible. Because as God tries to make sure we don't have anything interfere with Him, we do struggle at times with the things that we love becoming a little too important. And I know many of you that are in relationships, you talk to each other about this, and you write notes to each other along the lines of, let's not let ourselves get ahead of the Lord. Let's make sure that our relationship doesn't become between our relationship with God. Let's try to not love each other more than we love God. And that's a struggle. We love, and we love intensely, but we understand that nothing should take the place of the Lord. We want to keep things in its proper place. And so we have to deal with this, not letting things come between us and the Lord. It doesn't have to be relationships. It could be possessions that become very important to you. And you sometimes struggle with it being more important than God is. It could be an activity. I'm not a gamer, but those of you that are video gamers, you maybe have that challenge of enjoying that activity greatly, but once in a while some of those games have elements, you know, displease the Lord. He wouldn't want you playing that game. But you struggle. You love it. And we face this all the time. It may be our image. You have it's very important to you what people think of you and how you look and all of that, and that sometimes gets in the way of our relationship to the Lord. For some, it's circumstances. You like life to be easy. You work very hard to not have problems in life. And when problems come, it just disrupts you. You like it to be easy, no stress. In fact, you stress out about not having stress in your life. It's that important to you to just have everything go well. Or you know people like that. So how do we handle these kinds of things? Well, I want to talk to you about taking the things that you love and giving them to God. And as we go to this passage in Genesis 22, where we have our first reference to love in the Bible, and sometimes some have thought there is what's called the law of first reference. That is, when we have a word used for the first time in the Bible, that there we see it in its core essence, in its most fundamental definition and meaning. And the subsequent uses of that word or theme flesh it out. But in its first use in the Bible, you see it in its primal form, in its most basic fundamental idea. That can be overdone, but this is the passage where love is introduced. It's interesting, too, as we look at loving servants. The idea of a servant is somebody who obeys. And it's also in this same story I'm going to share where we have the very first use of the term obey or obedience. And so those are linked together in the Bible, I think appropriately, love and obedience. Here in our passage in Genesis 22, it's the story of Abraham offering Isaac. And the more I study this passage, I cannot imagine a more significant chapter in the Bible, in the Old Testament especially. Now, there are others that maybe have this as much significance, but this one has to be right up there as we see the themes that come out of this wonderful chapter. Let's read chapter 22 of Genesis together. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham. Test would probably be a better word here. And said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up, and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, My father. And he said, Here I am, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together, and they came to the place which God had told him of. And Abraham built an altar there and laid the wood in order and bound Isaac his son, laid him on the altar upon the wood, and Abraham stretched forth his hand and took the knife to slay his son. And the angel of the Lord called unto him out of heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, Here am I. He said, Lay not thine hand upon the lad, neither do anything unto him. For now I know that thou fearest God, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the stead of his son. And Abraham called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as it is said to this day, In the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. And the angel of the Lord called unto Abraham out of heaven a second time, and said, By myself have I sworn, saith the Lord, for because thou hast done this thing, and hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thee. And thy seed is the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gates of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned unto his young men, and they rose up and went together to Beersheba. And Abraham dwelt at Beersheba. I want to turn to Hebrews chapter 11 just for a minute and read the commentary of the New Testament on this passage in the great chapter of faith in Hebrews 11. Verses 17 to 19, as this is such a significant passage, here the writer of Hebrews, through the ministry of the Holy Spirit, gives us a little bit of insight into the mind of Abraham. And in Hebrews 11, 17, it tells us, By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, That in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And then the important verse 19, concluding or accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure, helping us see that Abraham's mindset as he went to this place of offering was that God can raise my son from the dead. So back to Genesis 22. As we look at this story, there are four elements to the story I'm going to touch on: the test, the trip, the offering, and the blessing. As we look at the test, in chapter 22, it revolves around three of the verbs there in verse 2. Take, get, or go, and offer. He was to take his son, go to a certain place, and offer him there as a burnt offering. It tells us he does this after these things in verse 1. After what things? Well, we were introduced to Abraham, especially in chapter 12, where we see God giving him the covenant. And between chapter 12 and here, the rabbis say there were 10 great tests. As you go and read the account, you may see more than that, but they've landed on 10, as if to say he started in chapter 12 with the first test, and he's had 9 more, and this is the last. After these things, after those 9 other tests, God gives him his final and most significant test. And this is the final test. And it's one that culminates with Abraham demonstrating tremendous faith. And he's to offer his son as a burnt offering. That's quite a test. In this day, the culture was that a father had absolute authority over the life of a child. So it wasn't that this was unlawful, really, in that way. As a parent, I can think back and think, that would have been nice to have had absolute authority over the life of my kids. Bill Cosby used to say, your mother and I brought you into this world, and we can take you out. Did I ever have to say that to you, Shelley? I don't think I did, but the threat was there, I want you to know. But for Abraham to kill his son, that isn't quite as significant as the fact that, of course, this is a very, very special son to Abraham. And we wonder, you know, was there something else God intended when he said offer him for a burnt offering? But it's pretty clear in the passage, Abraham, the only way he could understand this command was to actually go kill his son and burn him up. And from the passage, it seems like that is really what God wanted him to think, that he was to do exactly that. This test, by the way, is very similar to the very first test that Abraham was given in chapter 12. There's some connections. You remember there he was in Ur of Chaldees, and he was told to get thee out from the Ur of the Chaldees. In this chapter, he's told get thee unto a mountain. Very similar wording in the Hebrew. In the other one, he was told, you'll go to a place that I will show you. And here he's told, go to a mountain that I will tell you of or show you. And so some parallels between the two. In the first, he was told to leave his family and his kindred. Here he is to go and basically leave his son. So the tests are connected. And now here, just as in the beginning, he came through with flying colors. Here at the end in this test, he's going to do the same. He knew this test was from God. There wasn't any indication this was a vision or a dream at night. Whatever it was, Abraham knew exactly what he was to do. This was no inner impulse. It's interesting to me, too, there's no talk of Sarah in here, of him discussing this with her. Now, that would have been an interesting conversation. I can imagine him going up, Sarah, honey, just want you to know, the boy and I, we're going to take a trip. I'm going to take him, and at the end of the trip over there, I'm going to kill him and burn him as a burnt offering. And we need some biscuits. And I can pretty much hear her. You're telling me that you need biscuits going and coming, and he only needs biscuits going. Okay, I can do that. It'd be about three quarters of what, you know. I don't know if he had any conversation. There's no record of it. He may not have. And he may have. He may have told her when they got back. She's not a significant part. Abraham was just committed to doing this, and off he went. This was a traumatic test. Emotionally, you can imagine how this was traumatic for Abraham, especially because now his love is coming into conflict with his obedience. Remember the two words we talked about introduced in this chapter, love and obedience? Here they come. Abraham loves his son, and he wants to obey God, and those are now in conflict. And God doesn't let him off the hook with the intensity of this. As we read the passage, notice how often God introduces this thought that I'm asking you to do this with your son. Verse 2, take your son, your only son. Verse 3, Isaac his son. Verse 6, Isaac his son. Verse 7, the reference of my father and his father and my son. Verse 8, my son. Verse 9, his son. Verse 10, his son. Verse 12, thy son, thine only son. Verse 13, his son. Verse 16, thy son, thine only son. 15 times in the passage we're reminded of this father-son relationship. And boy, he laid it on thick in verse 2, didn't he? Abraham, I want you to take your son. And not just your son, your unique son. He wasn't only in the sense that Ishmael, of course, was another son, but he was the special, unique son. Isaac. What's the name Isaac mean? Do you remember? Laughter. The one that makes you laugh. Whom thou lovest. And so just layer after layer, God laid it on thick. What I'm asking of you is going to be very intense, and I know that. I know I'm asking you to give the thing you love the most that's most important to you. By the way, that's what I'm going to talk to you about this morning. Taking what you love and giving it to God. The thing especially that you love the most. Not only was this test traumatic emotionally, but theologically. Not only was Abraham in conflict with his love and his obedience, God was in conflict. God's promise, just the chapter before, in Isaac your seed will be called, is now in conflict with God's command. kill Isaac. God against God, as it were. But here in this passage again, Abraham rises up, and we see that the highest form of faith is that which can believe the impossibilities. Because if God commands it, it can be and it will be, even if it seems like it cannot be. If God commands it, it will be. And so here, that was Abraham's approach from the start. If God asks it, I will do it. I can't figure it out, but He can figure it out. What faith! And so he was able to give what he loved the most back to God, only because of that faith. And so it was a traumatic test personally, because that's exactly what God was doing. Inside of Abraham, there was laying latent that faith that God now wanted to draw out of him. And he wanted to draw it out now in action. Because though that faith is there, until Abraham is able to live it out, it basically is meaningless. And so God gives him the opportunity to now take that which is there inside him and live it out. And God does that with you, as he infuses you with this yearning for him, this obedience, this faith, and then he will give you opportunity to act it out, to live it out. James loved this passage, I'm sure, as he writes, "Faith without works is dead." That's the idea. Take that which is there, and God gives us the arena to now show it, so that, especially for Abraham, he now knows he has that kind of faith. God knows all along what's there. But God himself references in verse 12, "Now I know," you see. But especially Abraham now knows that this faith of his is real. And so for you, you need to act out your faith. And God will give you opportunity sometimes through trial to live it out in real life. Well, that was the test. How about the trip? How long did it take? 3 days. He gets up early the next morning and off they go. 2 full days of travel. 3rd day, they're now coming to the place. This was not an act of impulse. You know, sometimes in the spur of the moment, in the heat of the time, we can do something for God or make a promise to God or offer ourselves to God, but this was not an impulse. He had time to ponder what he was going to do. 3 days, you see, of travel. Time to listen to the questions of his son. Time to think through the ramifications. Time to change his mind. 50 miles from Beersheba to Moriah. Alexander McLaren would say, "Many a faith which could even have slain its dearest would have broken down long before the last step of that sad journey was taken, but not Abraham's." God took him to a very special place, a sacred place. And this place where he offers his son, there one day would be the temple where God's presence would dwell, as Solomon builds on that same site, the temple, as David there stops the curse as he meets with the angel of God. From that spot where Isaac was offered, Abraham could look and see Golgotha. There was the offering. His faith and hope triumphed. Verse 5, Abraham says to his young men, "You guys stay here. We're going over here," and the verbs are all plural. In other words, the lad and I are going to go yonder. We are going to worship, and we are going to come back to you. What faith? He didn't know how, but he meant it, I think. We're coming back somehow, some way. Now, he didn't just believe, as Hebrews implied, that God was going to raise his son from the dead. Understand, he was believing God was going to raise him from the dead and from the ashes, and he'd bring him back to these men. He was looking for some miracle. He was anticipating a God-sized event here. And so the offering is demonstrating to us tremendous faith from Abraham. And off they go. Even the question from his son. Verse 7, "Here's the wood. Here's the fire. Where's the lamb?" And his answer, God will provide for himself a lamb. Well, it may delay the inevitable. He doesn't really tell him yet, or does he? I mean, eventually he's going to have to explain to Isaac, you're the one, because Isaac is at least 13. Josephus says he's 25. The rabbis say he's 37, which is the age he's at when his mother dies in the next chapter, connecting these two into the same year. We don't know, but he's at least strong enough to not let a 100-plus-year-old man tie him up and put him on the altar. Isaac willingly let Abraham do this. That's very significant. When did he find out he was the lamb? It could have been right here in verse 8. In the Hebrew verb forms, the future and the present are the same. And he may have actually looked him in the eye and said, God is providing the lamb. And Abraham and Isaac right then understood. It was either here or probably just within the hour. And he lets him know, you're it. And so the offering is made, the binding is done, and as he raises the knife, God stops him and says, of course, now I know that you fear God, you've not withheld him. And then what happens? The blessing. And this really excites me as I look at what God did as he calls out from heaven, he stops Abraham from killing Isaac, he provides the ram, but then in verse 15, the angel of the Lord called again out of heaven, because I want you to understand what's happening here. As Abraham demonstrated this tremendous faith, there's nothing greater in the eyes of God than faith coming from his people. He loves that. And when he sees it, he responds. And when he saw it in Abraham, he responded to that. And he responded with a tremendous blessing here in verse 16. In fact, he gives an oath. He swears by himself, and that is very significant in the Scriptures. It's a rare thing. And so in verse 16, the angel of the Lord calls out of heaven again, and he said, by myself I have sworn, saith the Lord, because you have done this thing, and you haven't withheld your son, your only son. And so blessing, I'm going to bless you. Multiplying, I'll multiply you. Verse 18, in your seed all the nations of the earth will be blessed because you've obeyed my voice. God gets excited here and responds with a tremendous blessing that through the rest of the Old Testament is referenced. Constantly there's a reference to when God swore to Abraham. It's this passage. Hebrews 6, we won't take time to go there. One of the favorite passages of you and me as God talks about by two immutable things in which it is impossible for God to lie. We have our hope. And those two things are God's promise and his oath to Abraham. Both of those. And so this oath here, this swearing by himself, is a very powerful, significant moment in all the Scriptures. And why does it come? Because God responds to faith. When Abraham demonstrated tremendous faith to offer to God what he loved the most, God responded in kind with a tremendous blessing. Gave his son back to him. Even more precious now. In fact, now Isaac is a type of Christ. Hebrews 11 made that clear. Both were sons. Both were unique sons. Both were loved by their fathers. Both had their names chosen by God, not their parents, which was rare. Both had a father willing to sacrifice them. Both were received back to life, Isaac in a figure, after 3 days. Both sons died willingly. Both of them carried the tree on their back to the place of offering. And Abraham and God are compared. Both loved their sons and both gave them up. Romans 8:32, he that spared not his own son but delivered him up. John 3:16, God so loved the world that he gave. And so the typology that comes out of this, because Abraham did what he did and believed. So what can we learn from this? Three things. One, God tests us. And he does it to prove, to uncover, to show our true character. In Deuteronomy 8, he did that in the wilderness to prove them, to know what was in their heart. Psalm 139, O Lord, you have searched me, in verse 1. And then the last verses of that psalm, search me again, O God, and know my heart, and try me and know my thoughts. You see, here's the difference between temptation and testing. Temptation asks us to do something pleasurable and ignore that it's wrong. Testing asks us to do something right and ignore that it's unpleasant. McLaren indicates this. Temptation asks us to do something pleasurable and ignore that it's wrong. But testing from God asks us to do something right and ignore that it's unpleasant for the time. And so God tests us. He will test you. He will test you concerning that thing you love the most. Secondly, God asks for our all, and He asks for it by asking for the thing we love, especially what we love the most. That's how He knows you can give Him your all. When you give Him what you love, He knows He has your all. Love for God is proved by our obedience to Him. He that loveth father or me more than me is not worthy of me. Take the thing that you love and give it to God. And then thirdly, you need to know that your faith, your obedience will be rewarded. Just as God responded with a tremendous blessing and an oath to Abraham, God loves to bless your offering, your faith. You give what you love to Him, He can give it back to you in the form of a blessing much more precious than it is now. You withhold from Him what you love. Don't you understand? He has 1,000 ways to sour it. And so, whether it's a relationship, give it to God. Whether it's an image, a possession, whatever it is that you love most right now, have you given it to God? And then, are you in faith expecting Him to be able to give back to you renewed, recreated, and a blessing you cannot comprehend? Doesn't mean you'll get the same person back. Doesn't mean you'll get the same thing back. But it means that He will give you something back and you'll make the connection. This is better than what I had before. So how do you do that? You see, I want to do that, but how do I do that? One, acknowledge that what you have and love isn't yours. Don't see it as something you possess, but see it as a gift from God's grace. When I was a parent, I remember when our first son was born, I loved him. But I remember, as he grew up especially, understanding that he's not mine. I love him, but he's not mine. And parents face the fear of abduction. You'll face that someday. Just realizing somebody could just take this child, and I can't protect them every moment of every day, but God can. And I realized more intensely then, I have to give what I love back to God. I can't take care of it, but He can. He can handle what I love better than I can. Give it to Him. Secondly, be willing to live without it. Because if you give it to God and He chooses not to give it back, that needs to be okay with you. Because you know what? That's better. Be willing to live without it. That's the sign if you really have given it to God. Thirdly, obey the clear direction of the Lord concerning it. Is it sinful? Abandon it. Is it questionable? Be discerning about it. Is it good? Cherish it. But obey God's direction about it. And then lastly, trust God to give it back even better. Can you do that? Can you give what you love to God? Martha Snell Nicholson had 4 incurable diseases. She lived with pain and suffering. Her loving husband cared for her, and then suddenly one day he died. But through her pain, suffering, and loss, she gave us some of the finest Christian poetry. One of hers is called Treasures. One by one, he took them from me, all the things I valued most, until I was empty-handed. Every glittering toy was lost. And I walked earth's highways grieving in my rags and poverty till I heard his voice inviting, lift those empty hands to me. So I held them up to heaven and he filled them with a store of his own transcendent riches till they could contain no more. At last I comprehended with my stupid mind and dull that God could not pour His riches into hands already full. Would you bow with me? Heavenly Father, empty our hands. If we don't do it willingly, in Your kindness to us, You do it. But Lord, would You surge through these young people a faith that allows them to offer what's in their hands to You, willingly to give what they love to God. And then, Lord, pour out your blessing in such ways that they cannot comprehend how one would ever think to hold back from you. And for those that are struggling with this today, let Abraham's faith rise up in them. Help them. For Jesus' sake, amen.